started with a tooth abscess that was very bad, and she developed a virus and got extremely sick and just stopped eating. So that was in March 2008, exactly 3 years later, plus a week, she took her own life.
It's a tough one this week, make no mistake about it. Annette and Stuart Baker and Frank and Ali Barrett are members of a terrible, terrible club. But they have decided to speak out about being in that club, hopefully to benefit other families like yours and mine. These families lost teenagers to suicide. Now, I should give you the number right now and again at the end for Lifeline Australia, 13 11 14. That is their crisis support and counselling number. This is the Nitty Gritty Committee, stories about the guts and the glory of life, brought to you by the Ford Focus, which comes with reverse camera so you can get into the smallest of spaces. The ticked up Focus is here. If you have ever considered suicide, and I know, you know, a lot of us have, this is a poignant conversation. This is a conversation with the people who are left behind. It's very sad, but you know what? They're very strong people, and those people who then decide to try and help others out of their own terrible loss and sadness. They're amazing people. So let's just sit for as long as you can with Annette and Stuart Baker and Frank and Ali Barrett.
You don't wish to be a spokesman, but you've got to let people know that there's bad things that happen out there and that you really need help and proper help.
Mm.
I think you've got to make the best, well, you can't make the best of a bad situation, but you've got to get the best out of what's happened. Chris was a beautiful person and he always tried to help people. And he would want us to use this to stop it happening to other kids and other families. And also, I think for me, it's a bit of revenge. Like, I'm taking revenge on what killed Chris, like the system, and trying to get the best deal for mental illness, you know, and trying to get the help for other people that Chris couldn't get, you know. Like.
What help is there for parents when this happens, by the way? What help did you get?
We really haven't had any. We've had friends supporting, but we've attempted to find help for ourselves and for the boys. And, you know, we have a grief counsellor in Albury who my oldest son, our oldest son, saw when he was 22 or 23, and she spent 45 minutes talking about Star Wars to him.
Wow.
He came home livid.
Yeah.
Yeah. He said, "Mum, we can heal ourselves. We don't need these people."
It's an unfortunate reality that it's not uncommon. Teen suicide in Australia is what are the stats? Do you know them off the top of your head? No, they're not great. We know they're not great.
It's the greatest killer of right? young men, isn't it? Between 15 and...
And so you would think that the next step would be family recovery after that and some kind of assistance.
Yeah.
Well, actually, the psychiatrist did suggest that I take my two daughters in after Chris died. And he actually said to them, "Well, did you think your brother was going to take his own life?" And my eldest daughter said, "Well, no, did you? You're the psychiatrist." And she stormed out.
Yeah, you know, like,
she walked out. So
yes,
because that sort of implies to me a little bit of blame. Am I the only one who would think that? Like, I'm sure he didn't mean that, but if someone said that to me, I would think, well, if I thought that, I would.
Why didn't you do something about
it? Yeah, I mean, not that we can do anything necessarily about it, but that really forces that conversation back on the person, I think.
Yes, it does. It does.
I mean, did you?
Steve just asked me before, because I told him briefly about what happened with the psychiatrist, and look it up on the internet.
Yeah.
What is psychosis? Piece of paper. Look it up on the internet. And he said, "Should you have you pursued it further? Have you, is he incompetent?"
Yeah.
Or anything along that line. We've gone, you could go through a whole legal wrangle and try and spend money on lawyers and waste money on lawyers. We want to make sure that people don't have this happen to them again. And it's not one psychiatrist. It's the fact that there is no support across the nation, more or less.
So this is because you all went to visit Chris's doctor about his condition. You knew that he was emotionally unstable.
Before he died? Before he died, we were taken... Oh, we weren't really given much information at all.
But the doctor wrote psychosis on a scrap piece of paper.
The psychiatrist did.
This is before Chris died, and he gave it to you and said, go home and Google that.
Yes.
He said, I think you've got early psychosis. He wrote it on a piece of paper and said, here, look it up on the internet.
And that was 10 days before he died.
That was, it may have been 2 weeks, because I think there were a few days before he went on medication.
Close.
Yes. But we also found out after Chris died that 5 days before he died, he'd had suicidal thoughts. It was in the psychiatrist's notes, and we were never told that.
Wow.
And here we are, leaving our son alone in the house unintentionally, knowing that. If we'd known that, there was no way you would never leave the child out of your side.
But also part of suicidal thoughts generally is keeping them from people who would prevent you from doing it, right? So you understand that you weren't meant to know.
Yeah.
You know, he was a 15-year-old boy. 16-year-old boy.
Yeah.
We leave 16-year-old men at home on their own sometimes.
He was bigger than me.
Absolutely. And, you know, he would have worked very, very hard to keep from you to what he was thinking for a lot of reasons.
He had a mask sometimes. He would put things aside, and that's part of our foundation is behind the mask.
Of course, you know, because he loved you and he knew that you loved him and didn't want you to know what was going on. So you can't be feeling bad about leaving him in the house alone. Annette and Stuart, what was your experience with the mental health system for your daughter, Mary, who was 15?
Mary got sick when she was 12 and she started with a tooth abscess that was very bad, and she developed a virus and got extremely sick and just stopped eating. So that was in March 2008, exactly 3 years later, plus a week, she took her own life. She had an eating disorder for the entire time when she recovered from being in Royal Children's for 2 months to force feed her to get her eating and back on track from the acute stage. She continued to go to school and play sport, and on the outside she looked like she might have been improving, but probably no one ever got to the nub of the problem and possibly, for sure, the eating disorder was just what you could see on the outside, but she must have had serious depression for the entire time. And I think at the end of the day, she could only see one way out. And I'm sure she knew what she was going to do a long time before it happened, and no one had an inkling. But back to your original question about what sort of support there is. For us, afterwards, there was nothing in Albury anyway that was suicide specific, and the help we got was inadequate. Since we've been telling our story and finding out more, we could now find the right people to talk to, but it's not an easy task to just go and run into someone that's going to help. You know, often the best people were strangers or someone you just have a chance to talk to or encounter, and they were sometimes helpful.
I'm so naive. I just assume someone will come and find you. I assume someone...
They don't. They don't.
Oh, I thought someone from the hospital or wherever will be on your phone saying, I'm that person.
They're
when can I come over?
They're actually frightened. That's the hard thing. They are really frightened, and that includes family. Unfortunately, not the old auntie and uncle or elderly auntie and uncle of Stuart's, who are, you know, you just get the odd beauties, and but you get a lot more disappointment than the odd beauties, I can tell you.
Suppose it is hard to know how to approach people in your situation. What How can I help? How can I not make it worse? I'm so desperately worried about making it worse for you or hurting you further. What would you say to people? What do you need in this situation?
Just keep trying, because, you know, I think people that are, you know, have experienced a child's suicide are often angry.
Absolutely.
With the world.
And angry, were you ever angry with Mary?
No.
I feel like I might be. I might have moments of...
I had Mary, a doctor, her paediatrician, say she was selfish for what she did.
I don't think that, darling, but I think that if it were my baby, I might have moments of anger, like, how could you do this?
No.
I could have helped you if only you'd told me. Never had that.
No, she was, you know, beautiful, dignified, and, you know, I think she thought it was the only way out. And I don't think she trusted the medical system. Yeah. And didn't think they could help her. And
she thought they were idiots.
Yeah.
And I think she's right.
I think she said dickheads.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
she was more clever than what they are, because a science degree does not very often give you the
empathy.
To be able to treat a mental illness.
Yeah.
You know, we've just started speaking with her doctors after all this time, and they seriously still don't get it.
I hate to say it. I don't know if you get it if you've never experienced it.
Oh, well, why are they, you know, if they are trained in this area, you know.
But, yeah.
They need to be better.
I mean, have any of you ever suffered mental illness yourselves? Is it in your family, depression or anything like that?
Not really that I know of in my immediate family. But.
Yeah, although, you know, when you read Auntie's letters and, you know, there are.
Yeah.
You know, there's always.
That's it. It's only recently we've named these things, isn't it? So we look back at our parents and grandparents and think, maybe. Yes. What about you guys? Is there a mental illness in your family?
I've had a bit of depression, but
and
nothing, you know. I've had been on antidepressants.
So how, Alison, how bad has your depression gotten? Have you ever gotten that low, do you think? Before, and I'm pre Chris's death, had you experienced extreme depression like that?
No, probably not.
Okay.
No, probably not.
So it's really hard to tap into how they could be feeling.
I think unless you've been that low, and the feeling of not being able to get out of the hole. You know, like, yeah.
Yeah, Patrick McGorry, I think, puts it beautifully. There's not many people that take their lives that are well mentally.
No, of course not.
Yeah, so.
But I just wonder how you can, if you can't tap into how they were feeling, it must be really difficult as a parent, even when you see your child's floundering.
Well, like Stuart said, Mary might have planned it a long time ago. We always wondered, how was Chris? We were puzzled. We were wondering what was happening. What was Chris thinking?
Yeah.
I always think, though,
what was he thinking?
Yeah. I always think that Chris didn't really kill himself. I always look at it that mental illness killed him. You know, like Chris wouldn't have done that to us. He wouldn't have done it. You know, like he had plans for the next week. He'd just been shopping and bought new clothes. You know, like he didn't kill himself. Mental illness killed him, and the system killed him.
Well, we know that mental illness can, you know, when we can't find the right treatment or something to help us, it can be terrifying, exhausting, just demoralizing, debilitating, you know. What was Chris's mental illness? How did that display itself up until this point? When did it first come on, do you think?
Oh, look, in retrospect, his mark, well, probably 10 months before his school results started going down, real alarm bells rang about 4.5 months before he died, when he started cutting himself, which escalated in February. Two really deep cuts where he needed to go to the doctors for treatment. So probably 4.5 months were the, like, that was the cutting. 4.5 months later, he died.
The deep cuts were clever cuts. Now, he had a swimming competition on. He loved swimming. It was a great backstroke and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Breaststroke, wasn't it? Breaststroke.
Yeah. Butterfly.
Butterfly and breaststroke, sorry. Not being a swimmer myself.
Yep.
And he cut himself on his thighs just above where he... So he could still go to the swimming comp, but not be visible and seen. It wasn't the... I'm here. Look, I've cut myself. It wasn't showing that. It was doing something with the illness.
It was only discovered because I found blood-soaked stuff under his bed. So it was like, you know,
That was the only way we knew about it. He was hiding it. So it was doing something that he needed to do in the illness. But
Gee, that's hard.
He wasn't a, look, I'm suicidal. He wasn't an attention seeker. I'm doing this.
Well, plus the psychologists say that, you know, like cutting isn't a suicidal thing. So, like, it's, so, you know, like... Actually,
It's not. I thought it would be. It's not in and of itself.
It's like an eating disorder, you know, I was told.
Right.
Yeah. That's
sort of 2 years later, it's not the eating. And I'm thinking, well, teach me what is it. I don't, you know, we were not educated with an eating disorder. And we, you know, Stuart and I shared taking 4 meals to Mary at school a day for 3 years. So... We kept her alive, and if there were not warning bells to the doctors from that, we thought that this was normal.
I think eating disorders are, a lot of people think they're normal for teenage girls as well, unfortunately.
Yeah, but, you know, when you look at where Mary came from, it was a physical overlapping to a mental, and that was quite different. When we look back, quite different, but we were in survival mode.
Yeah, and no one knows. We all do the best with our kids, but no one really knows, do they? We don't know.
No.
We're trying to affect them positively and push them in every moment in a positive direction, but we don't know.
Yeah.
Because they're computing things in their own way and... comprehending stuff in their own way.
Yeah. Well, Mary, when she was physically unwell and was in hospital in Albury, then 8 weeks in Melbourne, she would have died from her physical or, you know, her weight loss.
Was that serious?
Yeah, without intervention. So she was close to death, I guess, and maybe she'd never fully recover from that. Mm.
Is that accepted as a suicidal trajectory?
One of the people we saw afterwards, who was a grief counsellor, said that during the Spanish plague in, I think it was the early 19th century, or might have been the early 1900s, a lot of the people that survived the plague and nearly died later suicided because... Yeah, they just don't bounce back and life isn't quite the same and doesn't have the hope and the... And I think it is about hope. When someone hasn't got any hope in their life, there's not much... Well, there's nothing to look
and
forward to.
And that experience, that so close to death experience, she said, was, you know... But... No one knows.
And it's all so counterintuitive, isn't it? It feels like for a young girl with a great family who's had an illness like that to survive should mean hope, should mean optimism for her future. It's all so counterintuitive.
Yeah, and that's the mental illness side of it because if you are well, there's no way you even think about suicide. You do anything to survive.
Of recovery, she appeared well. The strangest thing was the food, but she was playing A grade water polo. She was riding horses at quite a high level, and doing achieving quite well at school also, but it was.
While you guys were taking 4 meals a day to school.
Yes, yeah. Just, you know, and she was texting if I was late, where are you, Mum? So she was not that traditional, you know, eating disordered girl, because they'd be running away from you.
Yeah.
Not texting to ask where you were. She just, you know, had this difficulty with being able to do it on her own.
She was compliant, wasn't she? She'd eat when we were there, but she didn't ever take a mouthful of food by herself since she first got sick.
Wow. Alison, when you found, if we can just go back to when Chris started cutting himself and you realised when you found blood-soaked rags under the bed.
Yeah.
Tell me about that moment when you found them.
Well, I approached Chris and sort of said, you know, what's this from? And he, I don't actually remember, but I remember the months afterwards, like just the anguish of wondering whether he was going to cut too deep or, you know, I think.
And did it signal an escalation in his mental illness when you found those? Did you
hell,
know?
Hell, well, we went straight to the doctors and he got referred to a psychologist. The first cuts were only surface cuts. That would have been in the 4.5 months. They were just scratches. And I'd actually seen him on, I think it was on his wrist, and he said he'd fallen, but then I looked and it was like in a pattern. And I said, well, no, it wasn't. And he told me that he'd done it. But then we went to the doctors and he went to a psychologist. When he had the deeper cuts, that probably would have been probably 6 weeks before he died. He was referred to the psychiatrist. I think my worst fear was that he was going to cut too deep. You know, like I didn't think that.
It sounds like you're in survival mode, like these guys. You were more about the sort of immediate dangers,
I don't think it didn't occur to me that Chris was going to hang himself. I thought that if he died, it would have been an accident, and he would have. That was my fear, finding him in a pool of blood in the morning, you know, like, you know, I'm sure Annette and Stuart are the same. I mean, they would have slept beside their daughter's bed to keep her safe.
Well,
you know,
with the cutting, we did get told after the psychiatrist, we had all the knives and sharp objects away.
We did. Yep. We'd put everything away, everything.
Yeah.
Like all the scissors. But then a few months after Chris died, I opened his mobile phone and a razor blade fell out.
He still had it there as a safety.
He had it. He had a razor blade in the back of his phone.
Yeah, because if that's
what. But I knew he had something. I just knew because he was too calm about me having taken everything away. So I knew that he had something somewhere. You know,
that sounds
really horrible because I was reduced to checking my son's school bag because you know that's what I did because I had to do it to keep him safe. Yeah. You know, like.
I totally get that. Did you ever lose your temper with your kids, with Mary not eating unless you took the food? I mean,
well, we were actually forced, you know, with the treatment that we had to come to Melbourne once a week after she was after she left hospital, and that was the most awful. We had day of our week. We all came down and back.
You had to have treatment.
No, it was like family, a family, and it was just hideous. It was like, you know, so there was a way in and, you know, the old, so how do you think Mary's going this week, you know? And and it's a long way to travel for that type of,
demeaning, undignified, and not very nice, and I can't imagine it works. It might work sometimes, but it certainly didn't help Mary. She didn't get the help that she needed. And if we knew then what we know now, I think we might have been able to find a better path and maybe have saved her. But back then, it wasn't to be.
No, and you certainly threw everything you had at it at the time.
Mm.
Yeah.
The trouble is, this help should be readily accessible, shouldn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it shouldn't be that hard to find.
This is what I had no idea it was this hard to find, because we just hear so much in the media about youth mental health, and I assume that services come with all that attention.
Yeah.
Like the Head Starts and all those programs, were they involved in those mental health teen things?
No.
I think they've come a long way recently. Perhaps they weren't there. Yeah. Four or five years ago.
Maybe there needs to be more education and awareness in schools.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think schools want to talk about it.
Well, let's start at the school that Mary was at. There was another suicide a couple of years later, same year. And they are moving and shaking.
Yeah, Chris's school has changed too, but what does it take for them to change?
Well, here in Melbourne, I know there are schools that had epidemics, in inverted commas, of suicide.
Yeah.
And they were so panic-stricken, they did not want to talk about it.
Yes.
Did not want any media attention because they feel as though that encourages other kids.
Don't send my child to that school because
it could affect
them. There's a club that's going to encourage him to not.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
With Chris's cutting, like they didn't want to talk about it. Like they talk about it with the kid who does it, but they don't want to talk about it openly because they think it'll encourage kids to do it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think suicide's the same. Like they don't want to talk about it. You know?
So now with the awful experience that you all have, what would you encourage people to talk about in schools or with their own kids? I mean, what is the message?
Well, most parents that I speak to now either tell me about how depressed their children are or how happy their children are. Mm. So, you know, I think there's a lot of parents that believe, you know, that all happiness thing.
Mm-hmm.
Why they're telling me, I'm not so sure about that. But I am also hearing, especially last weekend, you know, that when children are having their struggles, they are seeking help. And that is fantastic. You know, for me, that's great to hear because that is not how I felt or we felt when, you know, we were in this rigid system where, you know, a paediatrician was saying, do you think it's all in her head? Do you, you know, Mary, I think your virus is over. At her lowest point, I think you need to get back to school. I think you need to start exercising. You know, I'm going, right, this, I don't get what's going on. Yeah.
Too tough. Sounds tough, doesn't it?
Well, you're in this system and you're taking the advice that is given and clearly it's not really the correct advice.
So what would I say to my children? They're babies, but what would I say to them if, after meeting you guys, if there's an eating disorder happening or there's cutting or whatever, there's clearly emotional problems, mental health issues. What would you say to young people? I mean, I suppose you can't say, are you thinking of killing yourself? Because they're going to go, no, regardless, but what's the message, do you think? Is it about hang in there, life gets better? Is there, what do you think?
I think you need to listen and, you know, just make sure that things are okay. Kids are pretty clever. They'll hide.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Or block you out.
I think our boys hide their grief, you know. I think we hide our grief from them because, you know, collectively, we all know what we're going through and we all know that we are surviving and we are doing extremely well, all things considered. But you know, I look at the boys and I look at Stuart and I say, God, I hope everyone's okay.
Yeah, that's the siblings. I feel like my two daughters, they've got to, I mean, I know we've got to live with it for the rest of our lives too. But, you know, I mean, my daughters were 19 and 23, you know, and they've lost a brother and they've got to live with that forever, you know. And I think maybe kids need to, I mean, I know when people take their own lives, they're not thinking straight. And I don't blame Chris for what he did. I think I get more angry at myself for not protecting him because that was my job. Suicide isn't a solution, you know. It's not just one life. It's a part of so many lives, you know. It goes right from Chris's grandparents down to his little nephew that you never got to meet.
Mm. And know? Even further, and it's more...
It's yeah. like a hole it's, in your heart.
You don't know a lot of the people that were affected
no,
by his
so
suicide.
So many of his friends.
We've got yeah. families and children, but if Chris was an only child,
yeah.
we didn't have grandparents, it could have hit us, either of us, so badly that we may have done the same thing, and there would have been another victim of mental health.
Oh, I thought about it. I justified it. I justified it. Chris had no one. The girls had Frank and
Ali
everyone
told me
else.
That Chris had no one and I should be with him. And
I seriously went, thought about it.
And I went, hang on, you've got two daughters.
Yeah.
I knew that I could cope
if she had.
But I
could justify that because they
well,
had you.
Isn't
but
this
I knew
interesting?
Why she wanted to do it. She wanted to do it and I knew that she wanted to do it. She told me. But I had to play the you've got daughters card to look after.
Yeah. But it's interesting because
if
you,
that,
you Alison, you're the one who knows how you can justify suicide.
Yes.
Because you did it.
I could justify it. I could.
And obviously Chris and Mary could as well.
Yeah, and she knew that I was strong enough.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
If it wasn't for the daughters, I think
you I think might you just take one. It. The only way you can go on is take one day at a time. You just, that's how you start. Mm. You think.
Oh, that's all right, darling.
Yeah.
You think like, yes, okay, I can get through one day, and you get through one day, and then the next day, you know, I mean, I still wake up with that dread in my stomach thinking, hoping that I'm going to realise that it's all just a bad nightmare, you know.
Of course. So that in the car coming this morning, didn't you?
I think the only way you survive is that you think he's just gone away somewhere. You don't think it's happened, you know, and...
Well, I guess they're the two possibilities, aren't there? That I either try and get through my day pretending it never happened, or I try and face every last bit of it and try and deal with it that way. Which way do you guys go, or have you gone? Both, I suppose.
I've thought about. I don't ever stop thinking about Mary. Every minute.
Yeah, and it's good to think about it too, even though it's. There can be some really low days. You know, I would hate not thinking about it.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's, you know, I suppose I'm shocked, but I shouldn't be, that it's 4 and 5 years ago and yet...
It's still hard.
Wow, it seems like it was yesterday when I chat with you guys.
And it's still happening.
It never goes away. It never goes away. You just get better at hiding the pain and living with it. That's all you do.
Because...
It's just like a constant hole.
It's gone away for the community, so it's very hard to, you know, keep talking about it with, you know, there are some people that you can have a discussion with, but no, it's clearly they're over it. So, yes, you
That's
need to be back
on your
bike.
That's the annoying thing, isn't it? That's the annoying thing because people think you're over it, but you're not.
Through what we've done. Promoting a little bit of fundraising, which has helped Headspace and whatever.
That's...
And what Annette's done the same. But we've found that once you start talking about this and promoting, people come to you and say, oh, my first wife, she's my second wife, she's still struggling with losing her child and still copes through it. Someone else I know said, oh, yes, we'll help you out with the foundation because my 16-year-old daughter's going through these issues and stuff like that. Now, all these people are suddenly talking up and speaking about it or coming. And so you end up being a sponge absorbing in more stories
you do.
Yourself.
It's amazing
and
just how widespread it is, though. You know,
does it hurt, though, to be taking in other people's stories?
It
I mean,
I think sometimes it's better.
Okay.
But then you sort of think, ooh. You know, that would be nasty and some of the things like that. So, yeah, but it still will never stop the hurt that you have yourself.
Yeah. I suppose it's just very different to a normal death, isn't it?
And that's the key to it. That's why you don't get help as much, and that's why people don't know what to say because, as you said earlier, it's counterintuitive taking your own life. That's the opposite to what everyone else tries to do.
Mm-hmm.
And
if it's cancer, you are.
Oh, you fight for everything. Yeah, absolutely. And we do. We all know we have such a strong survival instinct.
And often with an illness like that, there's a lot of lead time and warning coming up to the death and suicides, just traumatic, sudden, and society has not been equipped to talk about it, and they actively try not to talk about it for a long, long time. So it's a re-education process that's happening. And I think, I know in our community, things have improved a lot in the almost 5 years since Mary died.
Because you're in a small community. You're in Albury.
Yes. Which can be hard.
Yes. Well. And one 16-year-old girl's suicide can create massive ripples in a community like that. Yeah. Everyone knew her or knew her brothers or knew you guys.
Yeah.
So you are in town. Do you feel like you're Mary's parents? That's Mary's parents.
Yeah, yeah. Very much.
Yeah.
Very much. You know, the year that Mary died, the youngest of the boys, Henry, was doing year 12. So he went back to school because he didn't, you know, he was probably no good with me at home. And he was told he needed to sit exams. Mm. His brain was like my brain.
Yeah.
You know, he was disappointed with results. He was disappointed with ATAR scores. We had to find help for him. And that, you know, all of that we shouldn't have had to be dealing with. It was very, very, very hard.
Yeah. What you need is to be wrapped up in cotton wool and nurtured by the community, but they're not equipped to do it. So I guess we've had to do it ourselves and try and, you know, just be open and honest about what happened. And with that understanding, you know, the people get better at doing things and the community improves.
And I guess for as long as it takes, isn't it? There's no time limit. There's no, you'll feel better in 6 months or, obviously.
People want to make it right. They they like to see you get better.
Yes.
They like to see you smile. And we have started an event on the winter solstice night for survivors of suicide and friends. We've done it 3 years now and it's really, you know, been wonderful for people affected by suicide. But, you know, to me, I think, why should we be doing that? Can't someone do that for us?
Of course.
Yes.
I think you should be the last people who have to be organising anything. You should be guests of honour and,
you know, and Patrick has spoken, Susan Murray from Suicide Prevention Australia. So, you know, we talked about this with Alison and Frank, and it would be great if something like that could happen in more places, you know.
So what are you guys doing? You've both in your own ways made this a focus of your life in terms of pulling something good out of it, which is, you know, sounds really twee, but trying to find some positive way of moving forward and helping other people. So you do the winter solstice.
Yeah.
Is that part of something bigger or that's your focus at the moment?
Well, it's quite big.
Yes.
And we also, I'm on a committee with Mary's water polo coach and we do a big splash event in March. And that's, you know, just a small part is in memory of her, but a big part is we raise $10,000 for Headspace.
Wow.
And Headspace was a part of a butterfly campaign that Ashley Argoon, one of the journalists at the border, and Stuart and my son Jack took a pile of butterflies to Canberra to Mark Butler, and within 6 months we were allocated a Headspace, which Aubrey and Wodonga had been trying for.
And they save lives. I've met people whose lives have been saved.
So Aubrey and Wodonga didn't have a Headspace. So probably out of our tragedy and the community getting behind it, and you know that was something they could do. So they all cut out butterflies and coloured them in and
signed them.
Yeah. There was a petition that went to Parliament, and Aubrey and Wodonga eventually got a Headspace. So that's a positive, and the community has been amazing. They've rallied around and. Possibly, you know, the first step, we held Mary's funeral in a public place because often after the death or a suicide death, children or their friends are excluded from a crowded church or whatever. And in our case, a lot of people came along and all her friends and the kids from school. And I think that openness started the conversation that may not have happened otherwise, because you either go to ground and hide, or you, you know.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah, you're right. There's a shame involved, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely.
There's a shame involved with losing a family member, a child, to suicide. My mother's mother committed suicide, and I mean, obviously she was a grown woman, but certainly it was a very, very big family secret. So just hearing you say that, that you had a public funeral, reminded me, oh yeah, there's shame attached to this. Again,
well,
counterintuitive.
They were not, you know, a person that has died by suicide was not to, allowed to be buried in the same part of a cemetery.
Of course.
So, and we've also our local newspaper ran a campaign called "Ending the Silence of Suicide," and we were the first to tell our story. We were reluctant, but we did it, and. It was supposed to go for a week and ran for 3 months, I believe. And, you know, they support our big splash and our winter solstice when we need to, you know, have stories. So they've been very good, and they won a couple of Walkley Awards. And, you know, so I think, you know, Aubrey, Patrick McGorry says, Aubrey, you're doing well.
Yeah. And again, you know, regional suicide rates are very high for people of all ages. I think men between 50 and 65 are actually our highest danger group these days in Australia, certainly country men. Yeah. Alison and Frank, what are your activities?
We've set up a foundation, the Chris Barrett Foundation. Mm-hmm. We're much smaller than Annette and Stuart.
Similar.
I find it a bit draining.
We
get very tired.
Yeah, it is exhausting.
The first year was a bit more for as an anniversary of to let people know about mental health awareness. We held it in a local park next to the school, which was also near our house as well. We walked through that park every day. And we had a lot of friends around. We did a game sort of day and did fundraising, had some silent auction things. The next year in the school with full cooperation from the school and all. This is a government secondary college. And we had speeches and we had a bands competition at Headspace we're running through. Mm-hmm. Our money was going to Frankston Headspace, which was in operation then.
Right.
It was one of the ones that started up probably early. I think they initially announced 50 Headspaces across Australia and then it got trimmed back to so many. I know there's now one in Dandenong as well. But it was Frankston was the only one from in the southern area sort of thing.
Wow.
And then each year we're sort of, well, we had an outdoor park thing. We're now doing, we've had a Mad Hatter's Tea Party last year.
Do you find it's hard for people to have fun at these events? I'm just thinking.
Our first solstice, we were talking.
If I'm going to an event commemorating a teen suicide, I'm like. Yeah.
It wasn't that though. We didn't make it anything to do with Mary. It was just, for people who were curious, interested, or wanted to show some solidarity or support to anyone who.
And it's the community for both of our events. We were talking to someone recently about it, and they own it now, and we organise it. But they, with the big splash, you know, everyone thinks it's theirs,
it's a separate event.
It's really good, except that we do all the hard work in organising.
What about the event? You know, the anniversary of Chris's death, and
well, this year we held a Mad Hatter's Tea Party at a indoor play centre. To try and get young people to come and play. And we had Headspace there with information. It was more an awareness so that hopefully kids from the local schools would come and get information on mental illness and creating awareness. We're actually thinking of changing it and holding it in Mental Health Week next year, which is October, because I thought maybe we'd get more coverage from local press or press at all.
Yeah.
It's
hard. So, we get a lot of coverage, but it's still really hard in the real world to admit that you have mental health problems, isn't it?
Yeah.
To admit to employers or potential employers.
But we don't admit that we've got a broken arm.
Yeah, you're so right. You're so right, you know,
or a broken leg.
Yeah.
So admit is I've had, before a big splash, a woman said to me, I've just admitted that I've got mental, you know, that I'm depressed. And I said, admit.
Mm. Yeah, you're right. That is the wrong word.
I think
word.
With
yeah.
mental illness too, I think a lot of people think maybe it can't happen to them.
Yeah.
Like,
sure.
You know, like it's something that, I mean, maybe you have to be through some traumatic ordeal to get a mental illness. You know, maybe people just don't think it can happen to them. It doesn't.
And as we were saying before, sometimes you think of older relatives and you think, oh, that person clearly suffered anxiety or whatever, but it didn't have a name then.
Yeah, no. That's right.
It was Funny Auntie Muriel in my case, you know, in our family. No one.
Yeah.
You know.
And some people do survive, you know, out there. You know, Funny Auntie Muriel, and
you know,
we have one in our family, and she survives, doesn't she? She survives beautifully. In fact, I think if she came into the system, she wouldn't.
Yeah. Well, I just can't imagine. There's no way of planning how one would cope in such a scenario. Trying to do that together, I can't imagine how. Mm.
If you don't have each other to support, though,
it's
only one, and they're lost.
Yeah,
now, I mean, I've had people say to me, you know, it's so good that you know you're still together after what's gone through, because they know of so many other people that have had something, and it's hit one partner so badly that they just couldn't cope about anyone else.
Yeah,
we have. I have had several comments. One from one of Mary's pediatricians through another person, and actually a recent comment on Saturday, they can't believe that we haven't moved away.
Yeah.
And I said, really? I said, do you think we need to move away?
Yeah.
I think nobody else knows the depth of the grief either. Yeah. You know,
they want you away because then they don't need to see you or deal with you.
Yeah.
That
bonds you together too, because it's nice to know that somebody has that same depth, you know, like of hurt in them, you know, like it's, and somebody understands how you feel.
You four are in a terrible club, but
it's a club no one wants to be
in. Of course not, but I mean, is it, I don't know what the word, comforting to be able to talk to other people? Are there certain things that you could only say?
Yeah, I'd to people? Find that. Stuart has people that come to his work all the time who, you know, sometimes just say, how are you both going, you know?
Because they're in the same club?
No,
but really. Some people just do it so beautifully, and they're, it's great to encounter them, and then others, you know, it's a difficult conversation, or it's the elephant in the room, and you know what they're thinking, but they can't say anything, and you just ignore it. But some are just beautiful. If you could treat suicide like just any other death, it would be really good. That would be a bit of advice.
Yeah.
Try and just acknowledge it's a death, but not treat it differently to another type.
Yeah, like those people that cross the street when you're going
past. Well, I had a paediatrician my first time in town after Mary died. He diagonally sprinted across the road to avoid me, and that was like, for me, okay, this is different. I know, I now understand that this is different, because we've had three other significant deaths in our families. Stuart's parents died in a plane accident, and no one did that to us afterwards. It's very, very, very different.
Mm. When did you, like, how long did it take you to be able to have a fun family event after this, like a holiday or a Christmas, or, you know, I mean, is it even possible yet?
I find it hard to go to family events, but we have travelled in the last 4 years. I'm a swimmer, and we do swim events overseas, and we meet beautiful people. And
how refreshing to be.
They all know our story.
Oh, they do. I was going to say it might be refreshing for them to not know, for you to just be yourself.
No, they all do. And our boys have been the last 2 years, and they just are really quite amazing, aren't they?
Mm. Yeah, people are good, and telling our stories helps.
Mm.
okay. Mm,
it does help. It's hard, and the first time is nearly impossible. But the more you do it, the easier it gets. You know, for the first 6 months, year, if I heard the word Mary somewhere, it was like a cut or a I'd flinch. Or if I heard the word suicide, I'd flinch. Mm. And just gradually, over time, you get better at dealing with it.
Mm. What about you guys? Do you, how are, and again, you've all got other children, so.
Yeah, you have to go on for them. We went to Italy a couple of years ago, you know, and when you're away and you're doing something really nice, you think, you'd give it all away. You'd give it all up, just respect. Like nothing.
And when people say you're lucky, I had someone say, you're lucky you're going away, and I said, oh, you're rare.
You know, but then you do find you do things too. Like, you'll do things because you think Chris would have done them.
Mm.
You know, like, and, but, yeah, you know, you.
That's interesting, mm. Annette. You never can feel lucky. Oh. If I said, you're lucky, you've got a nice
you're lucky
car. You're lucky, yeah. You've got a good, you tan well, which you do, by the way. that none of that can ever.
No.
Okay.
No. It's nothing. You'll
never feel lucky again.
You're lucky.
I'm lucky. But then I always think you could always be worse off.
Yes. Well, we're sort of taught to think that, aren't we? And then I suppose you should be allowed every now and then to go, actually, what's happened to me and my family is pretty significant.
Yeah, it is.
It's hard to feel.
It's hurt with us in different ways. Like you mentioned family things, and our eldest daughter had a child 3 years ago, and she asked us, could she have the middle name Chris for the boy? You know, was that going to hurt? Well, not going to hurt, but she wanted to do it as respect. Couldn't call him Chris because I think that would hurt too much, particularly the grandparents. But yeah. Mm.
Do you keep bedrooms and stuff?
I do, well, yes.
Like most people. Like
I threw out his undies and socks. That's as far as I've
How
got.
How strange. What a strange thing to have to do,
that's
though.
That's all I could do.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Everything else is still there. Well, but I made myself do that, and I almost cried, but. I go to look at his T-shirts and I think, yes, I can do this. And then I just like, no, I can't do this.
I just put them back in the cupboard.
Well, like that. Chris was a fencer. Chris had started fencing.
Okay.
And he wanted me to do fencing. And I'd started fencing in like 2008, 2009. And, of course, we lost Chris in 10. And I still keep, I've got his, because I'm the same size, shoes, blades, mask and all that. And my biggest challenge, like you talked about swimming and going to events, we had fencing competition in Melbourne 6 weeks after. And I had to compete in this Commonwealth Fencing Championships. And Alison and one of my daughters came down and watched. And that was so hard.
Yeah.
Alison won't go watch fencing events because if there's kids there.
Yeah.
I just can't.
Chris should be there.
Mm. Well, everyone looks the same in fencing gear and I can just...
Yeah.
See Chris, you know, like.
Yeah, it's like.
I had a whole moment fencing a big tall chap in Adelaide, and he was a couple years older than Chris, very good fencer.
Mm.
And he took his mask off, I'd beat him.
Yeah.
He was a really good fencer, I'd beat him. And I had to ring Alison. I rang Alison and I said, I've just fenced a Chris.
Mm.
He was the same height, similar hair.
Yeah.
I was miles away down on the beach walking in Glenelg, just having a great time, but probably not having a great time, but I just had to tell her because Chris was there, sort of thing. And,
see, sometimes I'll see someone who looks like Chris and I want to go up and hug him. Yeah. You know, like if you're walking on the street, your heart sort of gives this little lurch and you think, you just want to go and hug that person. You just want to pretend it's him for a minute.
Remember the little blonde boy in the basketball uniform?
Yeah.
Looked like little Chris?
Mm.
Yeah.
How precious that you've been able to maintain your relationship so you've got someone to call and say, I swear to God, I just saw Chris. You know, so someone gets it. And you've kept Mary's bedroom and everything?
I do. I find it hard driving around at, you know, preschool time or school getting out because of all the school uniforms that, you know.
And because little kids to me, because they sort of remind you of when everything was possible.
Yeah. Yep.
And when nothing.
And you see them growing up.
Yes.
You know, her friends getting their license, stuff like that.
That's so hard, isn't it?
It is. Yep. And another thing I find really difficult, and it's quite disturbing at times, is I don't feel other people's sadness. You know, I've had a very good friend die of cancer recently, and I talked to her. I said, you know, Kim, I don't feel sad, you know, because our sadness has been so, so huge.
Yeah.
I don't get... Do you know what I'm? You know what I
mean. I do, but that's Annette used to read to Kim in her last 3 months, and she was great company for Kim, probably because she was able to discuss death better, I think.
And I talked to, you know, I said, I know when Mary died, people don't tell me things. If they're doing great fun things, they don't tell me, but I would always go to her with a bit of gossip and a bit of, you know, and her kids said that they loved hearing her laughing, you know. I said, right.
Well, it's like we were saying earlier, it's like you've been all the way there.
Yeah.
You've been to the depth of mourning and loss. Mm. I can't think of it being worse than what you have lived through.
I think that's one thing you think, well, if you've survived this, you could survive anything.
Yeah.
You know, like you just think, well, it's nothing compared to what you've been through. Mm. You can.
And that's the sadness thing, isn't it, really? The when you're hearing other sad stories.
Yeah, that's right.
It's just,
I think it still amazes you that, well, it still amazes me that I've actually survived, you know, like, and I've actually, you know, because you think you're not going to get through it.
Mm.
And you think, well, I actually have.
It's certainly one of those things we tell ourselves when our kids are little, if anything ever happened to you, or we keep telling us, I couldn't cope, I couldn't live, I couldn't go on.
Yes.
And here you are.
The thing is, you don't have any choice.
Yeah.
You don't have any
You've got others to do it for. And that's where sometimes you see the older male take their life because their wife's left them and the whole family's left them, or they're on their own, or the farm's gone down or something.
Mm.
And they say, well, that's it. Yeah. I can't do any better.
Yeah.
I guess it's just a deck of cards you've been dealt and you have to play with them, you know?
Yeah. And there's also that justification that you can feel, I think. I think in the mental illness, somehow you can honestly believe that it's okay to do that. It's mum and dad will survive, that I'm not tearing their world apart, that I'll sort of just close my eyes and I'll get a rest.
I think they're so unwell that they can't see a different option. And they probably obsess on it and they're just not thinking straight or clearly or as a well person would. So
that's the difference between you talking about your thoughts of doing the same thing. I mean, I'm sure we've all thought, you know, but then you can be brought back with the impact of your child's death.
Whereas a mentally ill person potentially can't be brought back with those impacts.
They would never have those
that reality.
Thoughts. You know, this is, you know, the impact that...
Yeah.
I think that's a really important message, though, is that anyone who's thinking about killing themselves, like, just don't do it, wait.
Yeah.
You know, just you know, give it an hour, give it a day, just, you know, don't do it.
Life can be better, and think of others.
Thanks again to Annette and Stuart Baker and Frank and Ali Barrett. That number for Lifeline again is 13 11 14. I know that was a hard listen, but I hope it had something for you. I hope you were able to take something away from it. And I wanted to thank both families and encourage you to perhaps donate to Headspace, get involved in those kinds of youth support services that help all of us in our community, really. When our young people are in trouble, we're all in trouble. Thanks for listening.